Well, so here we are on, I guess, round table number two, and it's July 27th when we're recording. We'll be releasing on August 15th, and we've got a handful of people in the room. Brian, do you want to start off with a LaCroix meme? I assume you have one.
Well, I love how this is what I contribute to this podcast.
It's kind of your job.
It's fine. LaCroix tastes like when you walk into a room and forgot what you went in there for.
I don't know why. I don't know why. Ben, what do you got there?
Oh, I thought you were going to do intros.
Oh, no, not on
that
these.
Is the
no,
intro.
Pay attention, Ben.
That is the intro. Well, welcome, everyone. Joining us, among other people, we have Rebecca Kite. And I had a question for Rebecca. You have a little explanation of this on your website, but I thought you'd probably like to share about the name change from GP Percussion to now, is it Taki Music?
Yeah, it's one of those. Well, since we're all in the music publishing business, one of those kind of weird decisions that I made and was probably not the best decision. I had GP Percussion for a couple decades from building timpani. Some of you might have seen the drums at the museum last year at PASIC. And then I published some transcriptions and a book and also the Keiko Abe biography under that GP Percussion imprint. And then I'll try and keep this short. There's a import musical instrument company in Texas. There's a wholesaler that imports cheap Chinese percussion instruments, and they called them GP Percussion instruments, drum sets and stuff for little kids. And now they even do the bell kits and the xylophone stuff. And I was started getting angry emails from owners of the GP Percussion drum set kits that got them from Walmart and Kmart and right. Target, and they didn't have any instructions on how to set them up. And why didn't I send them the instructions? Because the wholesale company didn't have a website, because they sell through Target and Walmart and, you know, retailers. And they put, because they found gppercussion.com on the web, they just assumed that was the company. And I got really, really, really tired of it after about 5 or 8 years. And I'd even talked to the president of the company and said, stop doing this. And, you know, it went got better for a while. So I decided in 2011, it was time to change the name of my company, because I was so tired of doing it, of getting those. So I thought, well, I love my dog, Taki, my black lab. And so I'm working on these educational materials, and that's kind of a warm, fuzzy thing. So, you know, for kids, for like middle school kids, and, you know, and I thought, well, that's kind of a happy, cool thing. And so I decided I'd change the business name to Taki Music. And so I did. And that's why there's a Taki Music website, and that's why there's Taki Music other stuff. And now, after 10 years almost, I have, because of those publications from Peggy Sexton, the Tabarro publications, and going on doing the thing with Norm Weinberg, where there's a lot more distribution. And also I had several books that are out of print that I wanted to reprint, because I just thought, you know, they really, really should be available and for percussion. And they're kind of abandoned in a sense, that you can't find who actually owns this, except maybe heirs of people who, as far as I could tell, passed away without heirs now living. Mm. And one of them was the Frank McCullum Book of the Marimba. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's got a whole great information on how to build a marimba. It's in this, he wrote it in the 60s. He lived in Texas, down in El Paso. And I did research, due diligence, to try and find these people. So I wanted to make that available. And the most important one, of course, was the Blades book, which, as all of you know, you could buy on Amazon for like $5,000 or something for one copy, because, you know, it hasn't been in print for now 20 years. And so I did all the effort to find that. And, you know, it's a little bit of a wild card. I mean, you know, so I decided to, when I moved to Wisconsin, I decided to incorporate back with the GP Percussion, but form a formal corporation, so that it's a shield, an asset shield, like a limited liability corporation. And there's a special corporation you can do in Wisconsin that's got a little more of a shield for the owners of the business, personal assets from the company. So mm-hmm. somebody decided to sue me. I mean, it's hard. I mean, anybody who owned copyright to James Blade's book should be happy that people are buying it again, mm-hmm. you know, but you never know. So I thought it's, so I brought back the GP Percussion name, and it's only on that. So far, it's only on Norm's website because this just did it last year. So it's kind of messy, and that's what I mean. It wasn't talking music wasn't probably the smartest thing to do, but it, there it is. And so I don't know. So that's the answer, even though it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. But right now the company is GP Percussion Incorporated, which is a new company based in Wisconsin. They have a form that doesn't require you to have a board of directors and doesn't require you to do keep minutes and all that kind of stuff. It's set up for like farming families and really small businesses where, you know, your assets are going to be under probably $500,000 or something, or, you know, just really tiny, tiny businesses. But it keeps you your personal assets shielded from any kind of lawsuit against the company. So, I mean, I know that in the past there are people in the percussion community, business community, who are really liked to do lawsuits, but most of us would run screaming the other direction from anything involving a lawyer or a lawsuit. So it's hard to imagine, but that's the story.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've often had students and other, you know, our colleagues ask, like, should I incorporate? Should I form an LLC? What should I do? Like, when do you do that? Why do you do that? And my answer, as I've researched it, has been, well, yeah, if you need some kind of protection. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're hiring employees, and especially if you're going to, it's like, if you have to be, sounds like, pretty big, or be concerned about some specific protection, like you mentioned. I was going to ask, how did you decide on a price for, say, the Blades book? Because the Blades PDF is $15.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you, and I guess I'd like to pass this on to everyone, because this is a question that gets asked also, like, how do you come up with the price for a piece?
So my answer is, you know, the way that things are priced in our society in the U.S. in capitalist is like, what can you get? How much will people pay for it? When you go out and you buy something at a store or online, that's what the people who decided those prices, they're trying to get as much as they can. And so some things get less, some things get more. And now, because of self-publishing, and especially if you're doing, we're all doing print now. I don't think any of us are trying to make money selling audio. I mean, I did that with a couple CDs. And the last time I pressed CDs was, I don't know, maybe 2008 or something like that, 2007. You know, because you press like 1,000 of them, and, you know, it takes a while to sell them. But then people were still buying CDs. But, I mean, I don't see anybody shaking your head like, yeah, I got a CD project and I'm going to sell them for $15 each. And, you know, yeah, the CD cost me $3 and a recording. You know, when I sell 200 of them, I will have paid off the recording costs at the studio. And, you know, then there'll be 800 of them. I'll get, you know, $10 each as a profit. So I'll make $8,000. Yay. You know, it might take 2 or 3 years. I can make some money doing this. Nobody's, you know, you're looking at me like, what's she talking about? Make money selling music. But with print music, it's kind of the same thing. Some people look at it as like, how many pieces of paper does it take to produce it? But you're composers, so you know, well, that's like the simple part, right? But I look at what similar things are selling for and price somewhere in that. And if I can't cover the costs and make a little bit of money, I mean, all of these things are kind of, at least from my perspective, living through when you actually could make money selling CDs and books. And, you know, this is kind of a labor of love more, or yeah, getting your ideas out, or using it for raising your profile, or having like playing concerts, but you're a composer. So you can't go out and go do a bunch of concerts very easily, because maybe you don't really play the pieces you write. You write those pieces for other people to play, you know, so you've got to have some way to, figure out how you can make just the printing and try and get something for your time in composing it. And, you know, it's really hard. So it seems like there's sensitive price points. And I thought the Blades book, the other thing is if stuff is free, people think it's not worth anything. So you don't want to make it too cheap because people like, would you rather buy a BMW or a Ford? You know, if you had all the money in the world, which one would you buy? Well, both cars get you, they do the same thing. They get you from point A to point B safely, you know, on time, but you'd probably rather be in the BMW, you know, if you could do it. So there's also that kind of thing. So things, as you know, things get popular and you can sell a lot of them. And then you have, if you print up stuff, you know, like I think Pius Chung, for example, did a clinic at PASIC with his Colors book. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember that. He talked about when he finished his doctorate at Michigan, he did a session where he talked about articulation and color on the instrument. He had a method book for it. Mm-hmm. And they had 50 of them at the Steve Weiss booth. And those sold out like right after the clinic. All 50 of them were gone in like an hour, which is phenomenal. And so they, you know, Steve got more of them. And then they just, it was popular that day. And then it wasn't popular after that. So they're just like sitting. And I'm not trying to say something negative about anybody's work. It's just once they're not popular anymore, it can just sit there for a long time. And you can have a lot of CDs in your garage, like some people have, or you can have a lot of books sitting around. So you have to, when it's popular, make sure you price it high enough so that you get something from it. And then when it's less popular, you can always put it on sale.
Right, right.
You know,
well, it's really cool because I look at Amazon right now, the Blades book, a hard copy, the cheapest buying option is $117.
Right. That's so ridiculous.
It's really cool, though, that yours is $15 mm-hmm. for a PDF copy. It's like you could have easily sold it for $50 or something. I still would have bought it.
You know, I didn't really want, I didn't feel like it's right for me to like try and make a lot of profit off of it.
Right.
You know, I wanted to make some money for the work involved, and Norm's going to make a little money for his website. And it needs to be more, you know, I thought it should be with the Peggy Sexton books and most people aren't going to spend more than like $15 for an ebook is pretty high. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get all my ebooks from the library, so they're zero, you know. And if I bought an ebook for $10, that's a lot. Like, most people don't want to spend $10 on a really good metronome app for their phone.
All right.
Or even $3, you know. So, yeah. So I basically wanted to make it available.
That's really cool.
What the price is for, and maybe people in other countries can afford to buy it also.
Yeah.
At that price, with just the regular I'm trying to say, because it's $15 is like $50 to somebody in Argentina or $100 from other countries.
Right.
So, I'm going to be putting on the Keiko Abe book in English and in Spanish when I figure out how I have the website for the musical examples. So you can click on a link. Hopefully Norm can fix the PDF so you can click on a link and hear the sound, the audio. So I haven't quite got that set up yet. And I imagine it's going to be in the same range or maybe $20. I mean, it's, you know, and I want people to just be able to download it themselves and buy it and not be so expensive that they feel like they just need to like pirate it.
Right.
Yeah, sure. Brian Bloom in Florida, I think you had something to add.
Well, we pretty much covered it. I just wanted to say thank you, Rebecca, for doing the work to make that available. That, because I did not have a hard copy because of the cost of it.
Yeah,
I think there's one in our library at my school, but as soon as I saw that was available, I grabbed that PDF, and it's nice to be able to have on different devices or different computers, you know,
absolutely
accessible. So I just want to say thank you for making that happen.
And it's searchable. You can control F tambourine.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, Norm took care of that part.
It's huge.
That's cool. Man, should have Norm on today too.
I tell you, the most painful part was I had when I started doing the research on the Keiko Abe book, and 10 years ago, I bought a copy of the Blades book, the paperback copy of it, And the most painful part of it was sending it to Norm so he's going to slice off the back cover of it so he could run it through his the high-speed scanner. And so I'm not going to have the book anymore, you know, because it's got to, you know, cut the spine off. And I wish I could have done both. But anyway, so that book's gone from you know, the actual – I like actual physical books, as you know.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm lucky to have two copies of it. One I broke down and bought when I got this job. I thought I really need to own this book.
Yeah.
And so I think I got it for $90 or something. And my teacher, Dennis Griffin from Utah State University, when he was retiring, he told me, hey, you can go into my office, take any books from this rack of the bookshelf. And I went in there, and of course I took so many books, and I took the James Blades book, which I misunderstood him. It was on a different shelf. And then he called me and was like, oh yeah, so no problem, but I'm going to need that James Blade book back. Like, oh, my mistake. Yeah. Sorry. Caleb, I think you have something.
Did anybody manage, I think it was 2012 or 2013, I know, it was right when I was starting my master's, that Steve Wise mispriced it for like a few hours.
Oh, I heard about that.
Yeah. So I bought the Blades book for like $30.
And then that's when I bought it.
Tim Jones bought like five copies.
Yeah, I remember it being so cheap. I was like, now is the time. So that might have I purchased it.
Wow, that's cool. So literally there was a mistake and then they hiked it up later.
Yeah. Then it went back to a higher price.
Oh, funny. That's funny. Well, hey,
it was never $90. It was never like you paid on Amazon. It was never 90. It was always like maybe around 50 or something, 50, 60, something like that.
Yeah, sure. Hey, well, sticking with this, like, how do you price things you're publishing? I was going to maybe send it over to Marco because he hasn't said anything yet. Like, you've been publishing, you don't self-publish, but you publish with Mallet Tech, right? Oh, C. Allen now?
I'm both of them, but C. Allen most recently.
How the heck does like tell some of our listeners just how like pricing gets determined?
Sure. I mean, obviously, I don't really play a part in the pricing, but it's pretty predictable. And what I've just realized, I've noticed that the price usually gets higher for longer pieces or pieces that have more involved publishing processes, you know, more pages or more complex parts. I know C. Allen likes to print parts so that you don't need to copy them. So instead of like an 8-page marimba part, it'll be like 2 11 by 17 pages that are double-sided so you can perform off of them and things like that. But yeah, I've noticed that, you know, some of my pieces are really inexpensive, you know, my shorter marimba solos. And then I think one of my marimba quartets is like $38 instead of, you know. So I think in that case, it's pretty logical, but I've noticed just a few little business things where it seems like there's sort of like a floor that they won't go under. Like my snare drum solo with marimba, the one where the title's just punctuation. Greatest title of all time. You heard it here. I noticed that piece is only like 2 minutes long and the price is, you know, still kind of at a level that's similar to, you know, some other longer pieces. So I think that's mainly a business thing. I do plan to start self-publishing in the future. And for me, like if I've ever, you know, sold a piece to someone, you know, that wasn't published through a publisher, I tend to give a really low price because at least in my mind, like my money from selling my compositions buys me like 5 trips to Taco Bell. So my whole idea is, you know, like if I'm going to actually make money off composing, it's going to be from the commission and not from the copies that I'm selling. I'm more interested in people playing my music than them giving me a ton of money for it. So I'm okay, especially when I'm self-publishing, to keep the prices pretty low because it's more important to me. Like the price is just a wall so that it's like, listen, like I'm only going to give you this if you actually want it. I'm not just going to give it away for free, but it's more important to me that my music is actually being shared with people than, you know, me trying to like get rich off it or something like that. Because
that's a cool way to think of it. What do you got, Caleb?
Has anybody thought of, because thinking about what Marco said about just basically getting the music to people's hands, has anybody thought of doing like an Radiohead in Rainbows, Pay What You Want.
I've never thought about it.
I've never thought about that, but I do. There was a composer, Patrick Long, wrote. The name of his pieces are escaping me right now, but he's written a few things for like Andy Harnsberger and stuff like that. He actually had, I think everything was on his website for free. Smoke of the Ghost, there, nicely done.
Yeah, well, I think that's pretty common. I think, you know, a lot of composers are doing that. They're just going after as many performances as possible because they're not going after that $20 or whatever. Or they're going for royalties and BMI and resume.
And that's where I was going to go with that. Was I was wondering, kind of a broad question of the idea of kind of where is the money in composing? You know, is it in publishing? Is it in commission fees? Is it in performance royalties through ASCAP or BMI? Is it in mechanical, like, and I'm sure the answer is a broad spectrum of all those things, but I'd just be curious everyone's mm-hmm. thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Marco, what do you got?
Yeah, I mean, and as someone who, I mean, I still feel like my entrance into this field is relatively recent. I guess thinking back, it's been like 10 years now, but it feels recent still. And I think all of us have private percussion students, and some of them compose. And, you know, I see a lot of students that are exactly like me, where they wrote like their first piece or two and they want to get it published or something like that. And I was the same way. And there was so much I didn't know back then. And, you know, as I've gone through this, I've really seen firsthand. I mean, I don't know if it's like awkward to discuss actual like numbers, but basically, you know, the money that I get from royalties is barely anything. And, right. you know, the actual income is going to come from your performance royalties for the most part, you know, and I know Andy Harnsberger, you guys just mentioned, he's pretty close to me in Tennessee. So I see him pretty often. And, you know, he's told me before that, like, you know, a bulk of what he earns from composing actually just comes from making sure every program gets submitted to ASCAP. Right. And I jumped on that train once I talked to him, and I noticed a massive difference once, even like Googling my name and tracking down performances I didn't know about, you know? And then of course, you know, when you take commissions, I feel like that's really the most, as long as, you know, if you're someone that's charging, as opposed to just doing favors for friends, at least for me, that's been, as far as like monetary profit, the most important part for me. And with that happening, you know, that's oftentimes more than you're actually going to make off selling copies of the piece if it's through mm-hmm. a publisher. So that's really what I focus on. And then the rest is just sort of a little bit of bonus on top, I guess.
I would add, in my experience, it's not like if you're doing one, it means you can't do the other. Mm-hmm. So if you are selling your stuff through like a website shopping cart and your pieces are, you know, $12 to whatever, $50, depending on the length and what you think they should be priced at or whatever. If you see some opportunity for some organization wants to play one of your pieces and it's going to be in some big venue and there's going to be lots of tickets or whatever, you still have the freedom to just give it to them. And of course, that's a great thing about being self-published. But if you talk to your publisher, I mean, they'll probably do that too. You just write to them and say, hey, I have this killer line on a great opportunity and a lot of ASCAP or BMI money. Can you send the piece to these people? And mm-hmm. as far as I know, they always
will. Yeah, I've heard of that happening too. I've heard of that happening for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I think to kind of what Marco was saying, it's like where is the money? And it seems like if it's tied up in university education, a lot of those performances they can't take royalties on. So it's funny, like they can for a faculty recital, but they can't for a student recital. So it's like, I know for myself, a ton of, you know, the vast majority of the pieces getting performed are for student activities. So it makes sense to, find most of the money in like the physical sale.
I'm just curious, who's ASCAP versus BMI here?
BMI.
ASCAP. ASCAP. Yeah.
Does it matter? I have no idea.
Marco, what are you?
I'm ASCAP.
ASCAP. So Casey, you and I are the only two BMI people here.
Cool.
I guess.
Should we hang up on everybody else?
Represent.
No, we should just compare how much we make from royalties and then see which one's better.
Well,
I'm not sure it makes a difference for that part.
Actually, I think it makes a big difference. And I say that only because I remember a few years ago, there was a Facebook post with a bunch of composers, specifically percussion composers, that were just mentioning that I know were ASCAP composers and that were asking the general percussion population that were also composing, hey, have you guys seen a notable difference in your ASCAP royalties? And a lot of them chimed in with yes. Apparently a few years ago, whatever formula they used, they switched in a pretty big way. And I'm being BMI, I don't have a stake in this, but there were a few people that chimed in with, yeah, I've seen a noticeable difference because they had changed the way they factored those things. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any ASCAP people want to comment on that or don't.
I don't know. Marco and I have talked about this a little bit before. Like it seems like the formula is, I mean, I don't know what it is, but it, it's best to just submit everything, you know? And then it's always like rolling the dice. I get the statement and I'm like, oh, which ones actually made me money this year and which ones didn't. I never know. And I can't figure it out. It's like gambling. And it's like, it's all free money to me at this point because I don't count on it. You know,
right.
I do what I can to report things, but if it's like, I'll take what I can get. And it's just kind of almost like a game to me to see which ones make money and which ones don't. I never know.
Sure.
Yeah. I think they reconfigured the educational royalties and cut down on them.
Yeah.
Probably because they didn't want to start charging educational institutions higher fees. And they were getting a lot more, I imagine, they're getting a lot more of the kinds of compositions that we're talking about where there are a lot of student performances of them. And it's not really, I think it was set up for more of like concert venues and recital venues and those right. kinds of, like if it's a separate concert venue, like the Kennedy Center is not going to have like any of those, that sort. They're going to be paying like orchestra compositions and, so I've gotten things from my performances at non-educational I have one piece that I was playing of mine called For Alice. And the royalties on that, when I played it just for one or two performances, are pretty high. I mean, I get like, I don't know, $15 or $20 or $30 for one, just a single performance of it in a big venue. So if I was in a small venue, then it's much smaller. So that, I think the venue really makes a big difference. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Marco, I think.
Well, yeah, and I was just going to add that at least with ASCAP, it feels like the formula that Brian was talking about seems like it's just a little bit cryptic too. Because like I'll look at my statement, and certain pieces will seem to be worth a lot more than other pieces, mm-hmm. and I can't really figure out what the common link is to make that. It's not which publisher has it. It's not the instrumentation. It's not whatever. So I'll see one of my marimba solos that I played myself at like three schools. You know, will all of a sudden net me so much. And then there'll be there was a performance last year of my marimba quartet, one of my marimba quartets in like Japan. And it was 2 cents, literally 2 cents. I got a statement. I got a direct deposit for 2 cents.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Did you get a single check for 2 cents? I hope.
Well, I got the direct deposit. I went to Taco Bell and bought a nacho fry. So.
Right. A single chip. Yeah. It would be really cool to have a 2 cent check, you'd frame it instead of cash.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Rebecca.
I was just wondering if any of you have pieces on like Spotify and Amazon, iTunes and stuff like that.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Cause I don't have any of my compositions there, but I have 2 CDs there. And, over the years it's, you know, I've gotten to learn how many decimal points you can have and still have it be considered money. I think it's over to 5 now, or 4.00001 or something like that. So that's really... it's really the thing that I've seen because of my age, it became really much easier to do self-publishing because of desktop publishing and, you know, Finale and personal computers and all that stuff, and recording got less expensive, and we had kind of a golden era in the like 1995 to about 2005 when, you know, you could make money doing all those things, but with pirating of audio, and of course, you know, mass, also pirating online of print publications. Like, what's that? Scribed? Isn't that the Scribd or Scribed or something like that? They put people's stuff up there, like, for free. I mean, I've seen Casey's things up, you know, and I don't go to those sites, but I've seen, you know, in passing. So there, the incentive for, and, you know, I write a few things and I write some etudes, but I wouldn't call myself an active composer at this time. But it seems, especially for me, for recording projects, I had another recording project, CD project, like in 2006 and seven, I was planning on doing and had worked on it. And I just thought, well, no, I'm not going to spend my time doing this because there's no, it would be giving away all the time, the prep time and everything. It seems like this for people composing and have artistic ideas, it's extremely demotivating when you can't, I mean, you can't recover the time you take, maybe the time you take to write the piece, but even just to notate it and make it so people can read it. And so I guess I was just wondering if how you deal with that. Is it demotivating to be such kind of, you know, pushing into the wind on a creative career now?
Let's start with Brian. I bet we all have something to say here.
Well, I was only going to comment about the whole streaming thing. There was a number of years ago, there was an NPR intern that put up a blog post about, she said something like, I have over 10,000 CD or 10,000 CDs in my music collection and I've never bought one or something like that. And it prompted this whole conversation about music piracy and whatever. And David Lowry, I think is his name. He used to be if you guys remember the 90s band Cracker, he was the guitarist for them. And he teaches music industry and business at University of Georgia now. He wrote a response to her just kind of saying, okay, I get all your points, but here's the reality of why this is wrong and why this is bad. And then he wrote another article about, specifically about Spotify, and I think, or it was either Pandora or Spotify, but he said, my song was, the title of the article was something like, my song was played over a million times on Spotify and I didn't make enough to buy a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And he actually puts up the screen captures of his, how many times it was played, and then here's his royalty statement, and I don't even think he made $15. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's just,
yeah,
the idea of streaming is, you're absolutely right, Rebecca. Like, putting out music, putting out recordings for the idea of trying to make a profit on those recordings is gone, I think, sadly.
So how does that affect your, I guess my main question was, like, how does that affect you as an artist now in terms of your motivation to create your art as a composer?
I mean, for me personally, I still go about it. I just realize where I'm going to. And I, at the end of the day, I don't think any of us are in this to make $1 million or, you know, I think that these are things that we're passionate about. And then, okay, cool. If we can make some money as well to help our livelihood, that's great. So for me, I simply look at it as, okay, well, I know where I'm going to make money, but I know flat out where I'm not going to make money. And so it's just a reality to me. I'm not going to stop composing just because if someone records my piece, I'm not going to make any money off of it. But I also know I should never bank on recordings, right, or I should know that recordings are now more, if anything, used for, they're promotional at this point. You know, if someone's going to record it, great. I hope it gets on YouTube, and then that hopefully generates more interest in whatever that piece is. It's a sad reality, but it's a reality nonetheless.
That's why we teach, man. So that's how we make our millions.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
Well, I mean,
millions of pennies.
But to a degree, you're right. You're right, though, in a lot of ways, right? I mean, like, I always say, like, my livelihood comes from my teaching job. Now, there's other things that I'm passionate about, and I'm lucky that the things that I do and that I'm passionate about, like composing and performing, they support, like, they're looked at as supportive of my teaching to get tenure and stuff like that.
Right.
But at the end of the day, if all of a sudden I lost my teaching gig,
yeah,
I would lose health insurance. I would lose so many things. It's like I would have to take a very different path in life at that point.
It's true, yeah.
So. Might be nice to have health insurance.
I'm still only kind of have health insurance because I'm between jobs right now. So I'm paying for it myself right now until October 1st.
What I think is important to think about on top of just you know, videos of your music and it being out there, even though you're not making money on it, good for promotion, you know, getting paid in exposures. I think what's a big issue is that in our creative fields, basically anything that's fun, whether it be music or, you know, visual art or video games or something like that, is it's almost required of you to do this free unpaid work in large amounts to even be considered to get paid to do it. And when you look in our field, it's almost like to the current generation of people in our field, it's almost like if you're not all over YouTube and everyone knows about you because of whatever performances or pieces you posted, it's almost like you just don't exist. The kids here in Tennessee, you know, that grew up on YouTube as their main source of entertainment, when we're recruiting, they have no idea who I am based on my merits as a percussionist. They knew who I am based on the one video of music from Kirby I posted on my YouTube channel. And that's literally why they know who I am and that I teach at Tennessee Tech. And when I look, you know, I have other interests outside of music and video games are a very deep passion for me. And so I've also in my time considered, you know, maybe looking into like being an editor, writing about video games and things like that. And when you look at requirements for those jobs, they're expecting you to already be established as a Twitch streamer and have a YouTube channel devoted to gaming and all these things that you can actually make real money on YouTube if you get big, but that's so much work and so much that you have to do to get a job that requires so much less than that to be done effectively. And I think just because we've all now grown up in a culture where, you know, you don't make money off your creative endeavors as much. So we're all willing to do the things for free because that's how it's always been. And I think the unpaid workload to even be remotely successful just continues to get bigger and bigger.
Marco, look here. Do you see?
You're small on my screen. Is that Dark Souls?
It's Halo. Halo 2.
Oh, okay. You're tiny on my screen. So
old Halo 2 shirt I thought of wearing just for you and Brian today. I was just gonna add real quick, Caleb literally just sent me a link on Facebook with one of my pieces on the website Rebecca described. This is the second or third time you've done that for me, Caleb. But yeah, there are these sites that, you know, they're file sharing websites that have a subscription fee. And then people are just free to upload PDFs, and you can find all sorts of music, method books.
That website also has a paper I wrote for a theory class my senior year of undergrad.
Wow.
Up there for anything, money.
Yeah, it's anything anyone wants to upload. The good news, I'll say, is a lot of these, I mean, these are companies making money, and they're charging a subscription fee, and they don't want lawsuits as far as I can tell. So if you go to that site and you find some of your work, it's very, very easy to do. You can go to the copyright link and you don't have to be a member. You don't have to log in or anything. You submit a copyright claim. You click a little box that says, I hereby swear that I own the rights to this, blah, 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 blah. And in a matter of hours, they'll remove it. And I've had it with that site successfully done several times. And I finally emailed them and said, hey, I'm kind of tired of doing this. Is there something I can do? Like, can you just please not allow anything with my name, like, published? Like, I think that's pretty fair. And they said they do have this system in place where you can submit works into their supposed, you know, hidden server that no one can look at. And when people upload, it'll do a visual comparison. And I haven't tried it yet. I don't know if I'm going to do it or not because I don't know if I trust them. But yeah. It's like, yeah, it's, and of course, I think it's perfectly fair to say, like, no, screw you. I shouldn't have to do anything. You should just make this work. You're ripping off my stuff. But that's where it's at right now. And I don't know if it works or what, but I might try it because I'm kind of just tired of filling out the little copyright thing.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'll also add way back to when we were saying BMI versus ASCAP. And yeah, I think we kind of agree they're probably more or less the same. I will say I've had BMI, the people there will email me and say, hey, we found the following pieces of yours that you haven't registered yet, and we can't pay you unless you register them. Please register them. And maybe ASCAP's doing the same thing too, or NCSAC too.
I've not heard of that. PMOs. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. I don't know if they all do that or what, but I'll say like that is cool. And yeah, I'm terrible at collecting programs. And of course, 9 times out of 10, they're programs that won't get me paid anyway. And the one other thing I was going to say about BMI and ASCAP, if you're like I was and you're hesitant about engaging in that and you're hesitant about registering your works because you're thinking, oh, I don't want to participate in that. I don't think schools should have to pay these companies. Like, why should these companies make money when they have nothing to do with any of the creative process or blah, 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 blah. I mean, that's very much how I was feeling about it. And I had a nice conversation with Mark Ford, and he said, no, Casey, you need to absolutely register your works. Schools pay blanket fees. Like, they just pay a set amount of money to organizations like BMI and ASCAP and CSAC. And that's money they're paying anyway. You might as well get it. Mm-hmm. So I think those arrangements vary depending on venues and institutions, et cetera, but they're already paying.
Well, and it's the big thing as well was I remember getting my first royalty check and being really happy with it, but then wondering to myself, where the hell is this money coming from? And I went to another faculty member at Troy who is very steeped in that that world and said, how does this all work? And I can't remember if I said this on the podcast before, but basically what he said was, okay, imagine he picked like University of Alabama. Okay, so every time that they play Thunderstruck on their giant, you know, sound system, they're getting paid a percentage of every ticket. And that money is going to BMI. Now imagine that's one place. Now imagine every football game that day. Now imagine every football game for the season, and so on and so forth. And so at the end of the day, what any of us are probably making from ASCAP or BMI is a drop in the ocean. A friend of mine, he knows the people that were in Evanescence, that kind of metal band from the 90s. He was friends with one of the guys that wrote all the main, like, wrote the songs for the first album. He says that guy's ASCAP, like, royalty checks are insane still to this day.
I take offense to that, Brian.
Why would you take offense to that? Are you just jealous that you didn't write Evanescence's first album?
No, you called them metal. It's very offensive.
Yeah, what was that?
Metal?
What? We're not going to get into this discussion.
We'll get into this. We'll get into this. Hey, back to Rebecca's initial question. I find it very demotivating. And I've had this conversation with so many of our friends and colleagues, the whole streaming thing and how it pays you just nilch. I mean, it's just comical to like look up my iTunes revenue. It's like Spotify paid you, you know, a decimal of a cent, and iTunes paid you a dollar. And, you know, it's just like, oh, man, I'm making a whopping $11 a month. You know, it's a sad state of affairs for sure. But I think the key, I think someone was, I forget who was saying it, but yeah, if there's something else, some other source of income behind those recordings, and as a self-publisher and composer, yeah, if you're making the money at the sheet music level or whatever. So in that regard, it's like, oh, I don't mind that it's out there. It can totally be out. I just don't expect to make money. If I ever make a CD again, I won't take it to CD Baby. I won't take it to iTunes. I'll just sell it from my website for $8 a copy or whatever.
Yeah.
That'll be the plan. But then again, you got to think about that, because it's like, well, what if I release that recording on the internet for free? Is that going to lead to more publication sales? It's kind of like I don't know. It's like you could keep it close and not let it out there for free and hope to sell a lot of CDs. Or as a publisher, should you make it as widely available as possible and hope to make more composition revenue? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little tricky.
Brian Bloom.
I just had a comment. It takes us a little bit sideways from this, and it's similar but slightly different. And it's about, instead of printing up music, selling it as PDF downloads. Mm-hmm. And Ney Rosaro has finally gone to that with his music, which I thought I would never see. And one of the reasons Keiko Abe, A Virtuosic Life, is not available as an ebook right now is because of the piracy. You know, the high probability of piracy for it. And I don't know if Ney's using digital rights management or not to protect his downloads, but I'm just wondering if you all have thought about going that route instead of printing, because, you know, you print the books that I sell, the Reading Mallet Percussion Music and Anthology, I print 1,000 of those because at a time, because the book cost to me goes from, if I printed 100 copies, it'd be probably $20 a book. And for 1,000, it goes down to like $3 or $4 a book. And so I'm willing to invest in that and let them sit in my house for a few years as it takes, you know, as it takes to run through those. But for sheet music, especially, so I'm just wondering what you all think of that, just using downloads.
For me, especially right now, if I wanted to print in mass, I don't think right now in my life it's just not like financially viable. So I've been doing the PDF thing, and I had reservations at first. I would really be into buying the stuff to, I know Casey started out printing like in his house for the longest time. I would like to do that as well. But at the end of the day, I feel like if people are going to copy it, they're going to copy it. They're going to take the extra, you know, five mm-hmm. or 10 minutes and scan it with their phone or a scanner and make a PDF. So I might be taking a step away from them, but kind of going back to what Marco was saying, I'd rather have, I guess, music in people's hands than that extra couple of bucks from printing hard copies.
But yeah, I'm selling PDF copies. Would you sell PDFs as a delivery instead of, you know, actual physical copy as delivery?
Yeah, I do. I sell PDFs.
You're
now.
You're selling them. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I have been really paranoid about doing that for the longest time, just because to me it was so, all I could see was someone just forward, you know, PDF to their entire, you know, address book. And then there we go. There's 1,000 copies or whatever out there. But I'm actually going to start trying it right now just because I have access to the full version of Adobe. And so what I'm going to try and do right now is, if people try and buy my music, I'm going to try and watermark it personally to that person. Mm-hmm. So that you know, if Brian Bloom buys a copy of X, if he sends it out to anyone, it's still going to have Brian Bloom printed all mm-hmm. over it some way, by which it'll be So it'll be very obvious that when Ben Charles is playing the version that Brian Bloom bought, then mm-hmm. so that I'm going to at least try that. But for the longest time, I was really paranoid about that. And I would send out nothing by digital, just because I was really scared of that.
Change a couple notes so you can tell who's playing whose copy.
Nice.
There you go.
It's a mess of a conversation.
That's actually a good idea.
It's a mess, because if you only do digital, then are you able to utilize retailers? Like, can you use Steve Weiss? Can you use, you know, can you use J.W. Pepper? And maybe some of them are going to start figuring out some way to do that. And maybe they already do. I don't know. But I know for me right now, because Brian, back to a few episodes ago, we were talking about self-publishing and the problem of submitting that as like a tenure type thing. Mm-hmm. And no one's impressed by self-publishing, but what they are impressed with is your visibility and like range of distribution. So if you can say, well, I'm sure I'm self-published, but I'm in this store and in these different countries, and look at how widespread it is. They're carrying my works, and here's links to all their websites, blah, 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 blah. And yeah, my plan is to really reevaluate after, if I get tenure, reevaluate, because like right now that looks really strong, you know.
Makes sense.
So I don't know. It's a mess. And then you don't get, you know, you think of all those people at the Steve Weiss booth or the Lone Star booth at PASIC, and they're thumbing through, and it's cool. You got like a big shelf of your stuff in there. And
yeah.
Is it worthwhile? I'll tell you, my biggest, the most appealing thing about PDF for me is it's so exhausting having email after email, people in other countries saying, oh, my music didn't show up yet, and when's my music going to come, and hey, my music didn't come, and then you give them a refund on PayPal, blah, 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 blah. Like, I can't wait for that to end, you know. Brian Bloom, I think you have something.
Sure.
Right.
Couple questions. I was interested in the...
Brian...
I gotta get this
a screenshot of Casey's, so we got that for history.
Is it just Casey?
I think it's just Casey.
Okay.
For me, it's just Casey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Well, for the, I mean, we've talked obviously a bit about like the interest in video games for some of you guys. And like, Marco, I know that you've written some of those digital dances kind of inspired by video game music. I was curious for others of you, if you have, if any of your compositions have been inspired by video games and how. And Marco, you can answer that too. Obviously, you know, we know the answer, but how? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I've started talking about this a lot because for a while I was trying to like be professional and not seem like younger than I am. But I'm like, you know, video games are a huge part of my life. And if anyone has a problem with that, then they can leave me alone, you know? And so, I mean, like my one of my most recent pieces is a 25-minute marimba solo, literally called Music for a Video Game. And it's that particular piece is just inspired by video game music. And it's supposed to be sort of like a soundtrack, but like, it's not from anything. It's all original music, just kind of in the style that I think you would expect. But I think the inspiration, at least for me, comes from many different facets. In the case of the digital dances pieces, I did a thing that I used to do a lot where I like try to remember something I heard a long time ago. And then like, whatever I remembered is similar, but not the same. You know, I'm not like copying something, but it ends up being in a very similar style. And the two digital dances, well, my first two digital dances pieces, the very first one, the main idea was actually directly inspired by Sheep Man stage from Mega Man 10.
Nice.
And it sounds very similar to the opening to that tune at the beginning. And then with the digital dances too, it's actually Dota by Bass Hunter. And like the rhythmic ideas and the harmonies are like extremely similar, at least for part of it. And so that's like another vein of inspiration. And then I guess like the third one would be like I have a few collections of pieces that are like short little scenes. And each of those scenes, what I was seeing in my mind when I wrote it was an actual specific scene from a specific game. Mm-hmm. Like I have one movement of a piece that is inspired by the look of the overworld, which is this giant gray tower in the video game Resonance of Fate, which no one's ever heard of. But like that's really stuck in my mind, and the music is completely original, but it's that particular image in my head the whole time.
That's
so
cool.
There's sort of like three different approaches for me, but video games are basically all I think about, so I can't really write music inspired by anything else. So
I've got a couple, an older piece called Parallel was inspired kind of like what Marco is talking about by, this beautiful game called Dear Esther. There was this indie game that, just kind of taking what Marco was saying about the imagery of the game, but then kind of trying to just, I wasn't trying to make a soundtrack, but rather just something that evoked the atmosphere that I felt in that game. So I've got that one, and then there a more recent one would be Bullet Hell, which is it's somewhat inspired by video game music, but the kind of point of it is the juxtaposition of this, for lack of better terms, kid thing with gun violence. So it's kind of this heavy, you know, clashing of two ideas type of thing. So I've got a couple, yeah.
So that title's not after like the hell bullet genre, like the old school shooter.
Yeah, that's the whole idea is the idea.
Okay.
Sorry, this gets heavy, but yeah, it's the idea that we're kind of living in a bullet hell, given the fact that there's so much gun violence within schools and stuff that shouldn't be happening.
Of course.
So.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of like, I mean, you think about past like common practice period music, so much is influenced by poetry or religion, or like Debussy Lemaire is influenced by, I can't remember the name of the painting, but I feel like it's just a continuation, like whatever I'm playing kind of puts me in a headspace, and then it just kind of alters it a little bit. So I don't really write music in the style of video games, but the video game story mainly kind of influences kind of my mood and how I write, I think.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that's important, sort of an important takeaway here, and something that I like to sort of advocate about along the lines of what Caleb said, is that I think it's really important for us to consider video games a legitimate medium of art, you know, as opposed to just some dumb thing that kids do, because obviously we've come a long way from Pong and Super Mario Brothers. You know, just yesterday I was brought to tears by the beginning of Life is Strange 2. It was a legitimate emotional journey that made me feel much more than any movie I've ever seen or any work of art I've ever So, you know what I mean? And I think when we think of it that way, it's a completely legitimate way to gain inspiration that I don't think is going to get rarer. Mm-hmm. Now that we even have, you know, people that are focusing on making games specifically for artistic expression or for some sort of political discourse, I just think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, because I don't think it's some weird niche. I think it's growing, and I think we're sort of, in a way, getting over a stigma of video games being for like burnout nerds that was held in the past, because now it's a mainstream thing that really does have an influence over the way we think.
Mm, good point.
Yeah, sure. I think there's no denying it's huge. I remember years ago looking at like the top biggest entertainment industries, and yeah, video games was growing, and it was right up there with sports and music. And I mean, it was, yeah, it's probably much, yeah, bigger than that now. Brian, I think you have something, Brian Nosny.
Well, given the kind of panel that we have here, I thought it was curious. It was an interesting question. So a lot of us self-publish and publish with specific companies or have multiple publishers. And maybe if this is a loaded topic, we can edit this out, but I was just curious about maybe talking, if people wanted to talk at all, about how they go about choosing a publisher. Again, if this is loaded, then we can just avoid this in case you can edit it out. But
no, let's load it up. Let's get it gnarly. And
I'm as well. I think I'm with 3 different publishers and self. So I'm just curious as to what people's mentalities are on that.
Let's get the lawsuits rolling. Go, Marco.
I tend to be a little bit of a loose cannon sometimes, so I'll be careful. But one of the publishers that I've been with is the one that I started with, and I was unhappy with the way my music was being handled and how long it took for stuff to happen. And so another one of the publishers that I've been involved with, I knew personally one of the people involved who I had a discussion with and you know, was told of the truth and what would and wouldn't happen and how I would be treated. And so I decided to try a different direction and was much happier with it. But in the end, I would like to start self-publishing pretty much everything, just so I have complete control over it. And so that, you know, I can buy 1,000 Taco Bells instead of 5 Taco Bells every year. So in general. And the other thing is just, you know, I have had situations where, you know, a publisher I've been with didn't want one of the pieces I sent them. Mm-hmm. And so that's a weird feeling, too. But it's like, do I search for another publisher or do I just publish it myself? Because if someone's going to play it, you know, they probably saw a video of it online, probably posted on my YouTube channel with the information to contact me to buy that piece. And really, that's pretty much every time I post a video online of a piece that hasn't come out yet through a publisher. Or that I haven't sent in yet, I'll immediately get people contacting me asking me for the music during a time when it's not under contract with anyone right. yet. And so, why not? You know,
mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Was that PC enough? Are we?
Yeah.
Well done.
I'm fine by me.
I bet we're in the clear.
Yeah.
Good job.
I mean, I know when I was at Kentucky, one of the things that Jim Campbell taught me was he has a few different publishers and they were specific to what was this piece going to be? What was the market of the piece? So that's kind of what I've adopted. So like I self-publish just about everything, but Tapspace is going to be publishing 2 of my pieces, hopefully this year or next year, because they're more to like the middle school, high school level. And that's just not really a demographic that I am that much connected with, but they obviously have their hand on the pulse, their fingers on the pulse of that. So why try and do it myself and maybe get a few sales here and there if they believe in the product, they're going to be able to put it out to far, far more people than I ever will. And it's just not a thing that I usually deal with. So, it's either been those things or it's been a specific company already has a tie to it. Like I'm with Henmar for my chess pieces arrangement, but that's because it's a John Cage piece and they own the copyright and they gave me permission to do the arrangement. And so then they wanted to do that. So it's, you know, I mean, so there's things like that as well.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to part one. We'll continue next week with this conversation on episode 190. So hope to see you there. And thanks again. All right.